Welcome to the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast. Here, we speak with extraordinary games industry professionals and listen to their story to learn all about what they've built and who they are. GamesNet Berlin Europe is the international games industry initiative of MediaNet Berlin Brandenburg, the networking association for the media, creative and digital industries in Germany's capital region. My name is Simon Oler and I will be your host for this program. Today, Florian and I are speaking with Sebastian Stamm. He is a professor for games art at the University of Europe for Applied Sciences in Berlin, an art director at Supercrowd Entertainment, and a freelance illustrator. He also co-founded the Black Pants Game Studio. The great thing about this episode is that Sebastian and Florian know each other quite well. 20 years type of well, actually. And mystically, Sebastian and I get along quite well as well. Well, well, well. A fun episode lies ahead of you. Get ready. You will hear us speak with Sebastian, or Stamm as we call him, about what is important to him right now. And I won't spoiler that. It's a cool answer. We talk about his university experience as a student in Kassel, and how he brings that to his job as a professor today, and how he thinks game design should be taught. We speak about his career in games, why he moved from Kassel to Berlin, art and being an artist, and art and selling, and all the things that belong to that. And we also speak about groups, teams, magical golden combinations of people, and conflict hygiene. Very interesting. And of course, we hear about Stamm's life, how he grew up, what and who influenced him, and creativity that lies in his family. A very beautiful story. If you would like to, you can subscribe to this podcast on whichever platform you are listening on. We are very grateful and we're trying to bring you the best stories from the European and the Berlin games industry. So please enjoy our conversation with Sebastian Stamm.
Hello, Sebastian Stamm. Sebastian or Stamm, how do we go today? Because I never call you by your first name.
That is a very good question. And we've known each other so long that it's hard to answer that. So maybe Stamm, which is okay. Like my artist name. So let's stick with that. Yeah.
All right. You are a professor for games art at the University mm-hmm. of Europe for Applied Sciences here in Berlin.
That is correct, yeah.
You are an art director at Supercrowd Entertainment.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
And a freelance illustrator.
Yes, also
did
correct.
I forget anything?
No, that pretty much covers it, yeah. Yeah, definitely too much work, I must say.
All right. And yeah. Let's not forget Simon, who's also here, since this isn't a complete takeover. Hello, Mr. Co-host.
Hi, I'm very glad to be here too. Nice intro. Nice to meet you, Stamm. I'm going to call you the same.
Likewise,
I always feel like yeah. it's a bit of a privilege to call someone by their nickname quickly after you've met them. But yeah, so I feel privileged and happy.
Me
and,
too.
thanks for not yeah. completely taking over the show yet.
Yeah, yeah. I yes. won't do that.
Yeah, and also to Florian, right? Because we just started co-hosting, and you know, the hostile takeover.
Yes,
it's imminent. I can already feel it in my bones. soon I will be all but forgotten.
This will be my podcast.
And thanks for inviting me. Also, that's something I wanted to say. I'm glad I can be here.
Yeah. All right. We are happy you are here. And the concept for this episode, as people can already hear from our intro, mm-hmm. is that you, Stamm, and me, we know each other for ages, basically, and Simon doesn't know you at all. Mm-hmm. So this will be more like we meet at a party and I will introduce you to him by asking questions, and then he will start making comments and but still, I want to bring over as much useful information as possible.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I will start with some serious questions.
Yeah. Yes, please.
So tell us what is important to you at the moment.
To be honest, we talked about that like 2 days ago when we set up this whole podcast we're doing today, and you asked me the same question, and this question has been in my mind now for 2 days. So I don't have a very precise answer. I only have the current, like the present answer, and that would be, and I really thought long about that because the last 1.5 years have been very intense, like for everyone. For a lot of reasons, the main one being the pandemic. And important to me currently, like the first thing I would come up with is having time for myself and my family.
Nice.
We probably will be talking about that, but I spent like the last 1.5 years switching from, in all the different areas I work in, switching to different modes of running things, starting with the teaching, so that I had to switch to online teaching, which is a whole different cosmos for itself. And then continuing with working at Supercrowd, doing the art direction for a whole new genre of digital event. And that's something we probably will be talking about as well. And then also getting a new kid into our family in around March.
Where did you get that from?
just found it.
Yeah.
Congrats, man. It's not easy to find them. They're kind of hard to acquire.
No, and that all, so it's like a multitude of stuff that happened. And like 3 weeks ago, I went for a very long vacation with my family, and I'm still in some sort of decompressing mode because I spent like the last 1.5 years being at home and working too much and a lot on very interesting projects, which was probably the reason why I did that. And right now I just try to get some quietness back into the whole thing. Work too much. That's what's important to me right now in this moment. To continue working on these projects because I love them all, but to get a better balance in there, more or less. Yeah.
Nice. I like this question as a beginning question because people react very differently to that. Some will start immediately pitching their current project. For some, like you, it brings a process of thinking about it for 2 days specifically to answer that question. So
yeah,
that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was really nice to hear, right? It's like, I thought about this for 2 days. Nice. Good. That means it's working.
That means he has prepared more than us.
Yeah.
Probably. At least subconsciously. I'm always subconsciously preparing. I'm like, to be honest, when we met 2 days ago, I was like, we don't know each other, but we know each other in spirit. So I was like, I don't have to do anything for this.
just be there. Mm-hmm. No, and
presence, presence, my friend.
And probably I also forgot some stuff. I mean, what is on my mind as well is like climate change and all of that stuff. But like if I look at my current situation as a human sitting in a flat in Berlin, I think the most important things I mentioned. Yeah.
So. Yeah. And it was a good answer. I think that is something that is really important, especially for people who work a lot. And that's many people in our field. So I can completely understand that.
By the way, I happen to be an expert on not working and quietness. So later on,
maybe nice.
we can share some thoughts on that. I'm very curious, but let's probably first go into Florian's questions about more industry job related stuff. So I will shut up.
Yeah. And second half is decompression with Simon.
Yeah. Yeah. Feel good, wellness and balance with Simon.
Comfy shoes. Yeah.
All right. This is the Mayhem Podcast coming live to you from me. So let's talk about your start into the games industry. Mm-hmm. How did you become a professional in this field, and what were your first steps, and how did things evolve from there?
Where should I start? Probably I always liked drawing. That's where I start. I've been drawing since I can think, and I always enjoyed the process of drawing. So for me, it was always more or less logic that I study something related to that craft. And after some attempts at universities, I was accepted in Kassel in the visual communications department, and I focused on animation and illustration. And at that point, I didn't even play games. I played a lot of games, I don't know, between 10 to 18. And then I completely forgot about that medium and just focused on other things that you focus on in that age. And then I, for some reason, at one day, I was in the animation department and I had nothing better to do, which was great because this was basically the beginning of my whole career in games. And it was like that some people from the programming department in Kassel, they were developing their own engine, which was more like a passion project, as these projects always start. And they were looking for people to create imagery or concepts for games. And I was just there at the presentation, and I hadn't prepared anything. I was just showing my work and the comics I did, the illustrations and the animated movies. And for some reason, we clicked on a very organic and friendly way. And we started producing a game that we didn't know what it would be. So most of the people in the team, they all played games at one point, but nobody in the team was, like most of the people in the industry, that are a little older as the new people in the industry, they didn't have some sort of education in games. So we just tried to make a game that was fun, basically. Very naive, not very theoretically, just straightforward. Everybody was having fun and doing things, more like a jam, like a game jam. And after some time, this thing became a demo. So we released one level online, and after some weeks, we had, I don't know, 30,000 downloads or 40,000, and that was a key moment for me, because I thought, all right, this is very, there's a vast audience of people who somehow enjoy what we are doing, and that I can reach with my art and the ideas we had in the game. And this was very motivational, and this led us to develop the game in full.
Can you quickly, just to frame this, can you tell us at what, in what year, like what time this was?
I don't know exactly when we started, but I think it must have been around 2008-ish, plus minus 2 years, something like that. So it's not that long ago.
And how old were you then? What's your age bracket there?
I have to... One second.
Quick maths, man.
Yeah, no way. Very slow math. I guess mid-20s, something like that. Must have been mid-20s. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
I can confirm from knowing your age.
If I'm not mistaken, yeah. And then we developed this game, and we did all the things that you do when you are very, I don't know, motivated and passionate and want to found a company, which was the goal of one of the founders of Black Pants from the beginning. So we applied for a fund, which was called Exist, which still exists nowadays. I don't know if it has the same name, but it's basically...
I think I know this. Isn't this like a uni student type funding?
Exactly. It's like, I think originally it was developed for tech people. So the intention is, if you have some sort of new vacuum cleaner or something like that, and you want to bring it to the market, then you can apply for that fund and basically build your company, the first year of your company, with that fund.
Yeah. Yeah. We had at university, we had like a mini startup hub, kind of, where some professors taught startup to students. And
yeah,
they worked very closely with this. I know about this. I was like, I know about this. Okay, whatever. please continue.
No, and I only have praise for this fund, because it's basically you get the gift of a lot of money, especially when you're still studying, and then you can just start producing stuff on a more professional way. You can buy computers, you can buy hard drives, you can buy official software licenses and all of that. You can even afford to go to, I don't know, any fairs in San Francisco to show your game and stuff like that. So this is really, really helpful. I think this is one of the most helpful funds we ever had. This was like the kickstart for our company. Yeah, and we did that, and we continued working on the game. And at one point, we released it. And at that point, there weren't a lot of games on Steam, which is like the digital distribution platform where you buy games. And we were lucky enough to meet people who pushed the game a lot on the one hand. And on the other hand, I just think that the game we made was so raw and weird that it got some attention with people. It was also silly and at some point also very experimental, I would say.
What was the game?
It's called Tiny and Big Grandpa's Leftovers, and it's a third-person physics jump and slice, we call it like that. And you play a character that's looking for his magic underpants that he inherited from his grandfather, and you achieve that by cutting the whole environment. And that was something new. I at that point, nobody ever did that, like as a game mechanic in a game, being able to cut with a laser the whole environment and use it for progression in the game. Mm. And that was just insane. This was like a little, I don't know, I still have very fond memories of that time, because we got a lot of recognition, and then we won the Deutsche Computerspielpreis, the German Game Award, and we were also invited to the Independent Game Festival. And that was like Disneyland for us, because we were just sitting there for, I don't know, 5 years studying, and then we suddenly had access to this whole industry and world of people making games. And then we met a lot of interesting and inspiring people on that journey. So this sounds a little cheesy, but it really was a great time for us as friends and as a company and as a studio. And this was like the base. And from mm-hmm. that on, we just continued making games. Some of them were like commission work. Some of the other games we made were like artistic productions we did by ourselves, for example, Rusty Trails. That was our latest game. We also did some mobile titles. We did some satirical games for Schlecky Silberstein at the Bohemian Browser Ballet, which is like a different format where you have some daily news and you try to make a game from these news. Like when Trump released his Muslim ban, we made a satiric game about the Muslim ban. That contains peeing, so it's a very weird game, but I still like it. It's a very small game, and that's what we did. That's what we did for a long time. And at some point, and did I answer the question?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Should I
answered the question and then some.
And then I continued. Yeah.
As things go.
Yes. I will stop here, right?
Yes.
That's what I do now. Okay.
Or you continue. That really depends on when you think.
On how your mouth you have talked moves.
No.
Hey, I have a really quick comment, because it always perks up to me with the, you said this thing, it's a little cheesy, you know, you had this Disneyland ride time.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, if anybody who's listening maybe feels the same way, or you feel that way, like, I really want to advocate for, you know, not feeling cheesy about it, because it's like, yeah, like, come on, you have your first success after you were a student. Like, of course, that's awesome. Like,
you get
a peek behind the curtain for the first time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
and
yeah,
you
yeah.
happen to be successful. And I just Googled the game while, yeah. and I saw a Total Biscuit video, you know.
Yes.
Like the WTF is. And you know, like, mm-hmm. that's awesome, man. That's not cheesy. It's called awesome. So I just want to say that.
I totally agree. Maybe I reframe it. I don't think that the thing as it is cheesy. I think more like, when I think about that time, I see myself as a delirious person running around being happy. And that's to me. That's to me. I have a very romantic and positive. That's really true, because maybe to add to that point, one thing that I really enjoyed and that I never I've never met before in that kind of capacity was that the community we encountered at that point. That was very nice. So to meet people that make inspiring games and that have very interesting thoughts and ideas and that were all quirky. This kind of realm I've never met before. I know that Johannes, one of our coders, the main coder, he was very active in the demo scene. But for me, this was like the first time having a real big contact with the whole indie game scene. Yeah.
All right. As sort of a, you mentioned it at one point when you told about how you engaged the people who later became Black Pants. But since we've known each other for over 20 years, I have come to know you as someone who starts amazing projects or interesting companies and has crazy ideas. So what I always wonder to an extent, to some part I know already, but I want to go more into like how you think about that. Is this like starting new things, starting a company, is that something that you feel comes from an inner drive that you have, or is there some external initiators that tickles your sense for adventure and then you just go?
That's a very good question. Maybe I can answer it from four directions, probably.
You sure it isn't six or seven?
A four-dimensional answer.
Four-dimensional answer. So, I really enjoyed it. No, it's like, where should I start? It's like, of course, I'm. For me, this is on one hand, it's like a drug to do new stuff. I'm well aware of that, and my wife knows that, and all the people around me know that. That I really enjoy that. I get bored after 5 years. That's a observation I made about myself recently, or after 6 years or something. That's one thing that I really want to do: explore different things and not stay at a place too long. That has changed a little with me becoming a father, because I simply don't have the double energy I used to have, and I don't sleep.
Oh man, I had this terrible thought in my mind, which was like, since we discussed that you acquired a new child, right? Yeah. I hope you don't get tired of it after 6 years. You know?
Now I get something else.
You get tired of it right now, right? Because it's awake at night. Oh man, okay, sorry. Oh my god.
No, and it's more like that's one impulse, and the other impulse is that there's also an observation I had now, like. Looking back at the projects I did in the last 10 or 15 years, that all these projects, they develop organically, I would say. And they also often start as a artistic collaboration. So just people I like and I enjoy being around and that have a interesting spin on things. And with these people, I start doing things. And from that stuff, something develops. And that was always the case. That was the case when I was studying. We had the small room with five people that I to myself always call this like a golden combination of people, like a band. So if you have like the perfect combination of people, and for games, it's often important to have this combination of people and not just one person. Not necessarily, but most of the time you need this kind of team, then you can do stuff together on a much more interesting and bigger scale, I would say. That's another reason. So that all these projects, I never applied at any company. I just met people and then we started doing things. And that was always very, that felt right to me to be organically connected to the people I work with on several levels. So that's another thing. And I don't know. Also, at one point, of course, I don't know, artistic reasons. If you do the same genre for some years, then I personally get bored and I want to do something new. It's also something that happens. And maybe to close that, these kind of golden combinations or bands, or how you want to call them, these people who work together well, these combinations, they don't last forever, to my understanding. Probably at some point some will, but like if your life changes, some people move to different areas. They have different goals in life and all of that. Yeah. So you come together for this moment in time of 1 to 5 years. You work together, and then a new thing happens, and you form a new team. And that's somewhat interesting to me also, and very aufregend, exciting. To see what the next project is. Yeah.
I really hope that's only a work thing for your marriage.
Yeah.
I had the same thought as well. Yeah. I was like, no way I can say this. And here's Florian.
But I can.
We know each other. We tell us everything. Yeah, it's just a work thing. We've been together way longer, and you know that.
Yeah. You pass this 6 years. Yeah. Stamm gets bored, Mark.
Yeah.
Good. So, as we heard, you are now in Berlin, but that hasn't always been the case in the framework of your professional life. So you started Black Pants in Kassel, mm-hmm. and at one point, you and part of the team decided to move to Berlin and open a second office here.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what were the factors for that decision, and how that came to be?
Definitely the game scene in Berlin. That was one thing that attracted us. So all the different meetups, you have these huge amount of people who create games and that you can talk to. And it's always nice to see people in person. So that was one big factor for us. And after 8 years in Kassel, we also had the feeling that we all wanted to go somewhere else. Some of our partners, for example, my wife, if she wouldn't have found a job in Kassel, which is, she's a textile designer, and Berlin is a much better city for that. And it was the same with Toby's partner, and so on and so further. So, a lot of rational reasons, I would say, and also some emotional ones that we wanted to explore a new city. See new stuff maybe, and it wasn't the same for everyone. Some people in the team, they as you know, mm-hmm. They stayed in Kassel because for various reasons, and so some of them, they don't actually care where they are. But I think at least for me and Tobias, who's our game designer, it was always important to come to a different city. And of course, funding was also a topic on the economic side. So we had this funding in Hessen. What's this in English?
Hessia.
Hessia. Thank you. We had this funding program in Hessia, and we also wanted to do like a double funding, like a cooperation with another funding department. And then there's the Medium Board, and we had very nice encounters with the Medium Board. So it just made sense to have these both locations that were more or less tailored to the life realities of all the team members. I think that's a good wrap-up point.
So as a founder and someone who went through these steps, of course, now this is a little bit compressed in this podcast, but obviously that was a longer period of your time and all the experiences that you made from that. Mm-hmm. What do you tell your students today mm-hmm. when they ask about entrepreneurship and starting mm-hmm. their own projects?
That was always, because I think I can talk about that topic from firsthand experience. So this was always one of the babies I had at the university, and I hopefully can continue to have them when I return from my paternal leave now, is that that founding teaches you a lot of stuff in a very stressful manner, but it's a good experience. So the incubator, for example, at our university, that's something I designed with my colleague Chonga Baranyai and also some other professors over the years. And I think that's it's just a great experience. I think it's not for everyone, of course, because you need all these like qualities of you have to motivate yourself and you have to have some certain. You don't even need a goal, I would say. you just need some people that work well together. I think that's if I would boil it down to that point, because I've accompanied teams over the last 4 years now at the university that did.
Quick interjection: are you speaking about the students right now? Like when you're opening up with that's not for everyone. You mean like the incubator?
It's exactly
not for every student. Okay, just to clarify that. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Maybe to clarify even more, I think, you need people who really want to work together on the one hand, and it's also something that I would say really it has to fit your profile as a person. Do you enjoy that kind of thing? Do you like this switching a lot, or are you rather a person that wants introvert, extrovert, all of that idea?
Maybe you can explain a bit what kind of this incubator that you're talking about requires of the students. I think that would paint a lot clearer picture.
It's something like, okay, so at the university we have this Bachelor of Game Design. Maybe we start at that point. And our students study game design, and they can specialize in various fields. They can specialize in game art or game design or programming during the course of their studies. And in one semester, they can do an internship or they can go to the incubator and apply for a founding internship. And we have fixed regulations, what we want from them, which is a lot of stuff, like a business plan, a first draft of a business plan, let's call it like that. And they also need something that is already working. So the normal way students come to that internship, this founding incubator internship, is that they develop a game during their study, like a prototype. And with that prototype, that is very much fun to play, or people enjoy it a lot, or that has some potential in any direction, politically or on society topics, that is a good prototype. And they take this prototype to the founding garage, that's what it's called, and they develop it to the next level. And that level can also differ, but for games, we always develop this to be able to apply for funding. So this was one of the goals in the founder's garage. Or they even develop the prototypes further to have an early access, for example, or to release the game in an early state, or to apply at a publisher. And while they were doing that, they also had to do some tasks. So we designed a program around that. They had to visit some conventions. They had to meet business people, talk to business officials. They even have to found a company. So they get a feeling of this whole legal structure thing that you also have to know when you start a company and all of that. So it's a pretty intense package.
Sounds fantastic, though. I mean, like, who doesn't want to? Yeah, well, probably some. That's what you said. But I guess I can speak for myself. These sound like dope tasks to do. Like, hey, go to a convention, speak to some business people. Hell yeah, man.
Of course.
Found a company. Okay, you're going to help me? But yeah, like, sure. That's awesome, man.
Yeah. Yeah. And and that's what I learned from these 4 years doing that. It really boils down to how's the team working? What kind of hygiene does the team have in conflicts? How do they handle conflicts and all of that? So if the team works well together, the program works perfectly. If the team is too big or too small, or if you have like double roles in there, this is a very special field, but this is more like team building. And if that works, then the program was successful. Yeah.
All right. I have another university question.
Yes.
You studied at the School of Art in Kassel. Mm-hmm. And that school emphasizes a very free and self-driven way of learning.
Yeah.
And to my knowledge, they still haven't adopted this whole bachelor-master system.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
Now, as a professor, you teach at a private university that has a more usual system. And as you said, through the incubator, even goes like the extra mile of preparing students directly for a career in the games industry.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that difference a little bit in terms of what it means to learn in these environments, mm-hmm. and what has it taught you about teaching coming from this very different kind of learning experience?
Mm. That is a very good question, because I still don't have the final answer, but I have some observations on that. Maybe starting with...
You can do it four-dimensionally again. It doesn't.
I always have these.
Yeah.
No, I won't do that. Or maybe yes. Yeah. It's once again. It's once again. It has several factors. Yeah, I know that. No, I think me personally, as the person that I am, I really enjoyed studying in Kassel and having all that freedom. Just to give you some context, you applied in Kassel with a portfolio, and then only a very small number of people are taken, obviously, like with every state art university. But once you have that, you're totally free. You can do whatever you want. You can do photography for a year, and then you can do illustration, and you can do all of that. And you don't have any tests. You just do stuff. And I think this whole didactics and education question, that it always boils down to what do you want to have in the end? What kind of personality do you want to hope to create, and what kind of traits should this personality have? And Kassel is a very art-centered university in a way that they try to form people that are very self-independent, very strong, and very like one-man armies, more or less. Because mm-hmm. Which makes sense, because I studied illustration, and most illustrators I know, except in the game, but also in the game industry, most illustrators I know, they work for themselves. They are freelancers, so it makes total sense to say, okay, that this, if the students leave this university, they are capable of doing that all by themselves. And of course, this once again caused some of my fellow students to not do anything or do a lot of party. And I don't know, I did also did a lot of party, but I also worked a lot with my roommates. And yeah, it makes sense. Like to define what would be the best outcome of the education there. And the university I teach now, this is a Fachhochschule, so a university of applied sciences. And this is a little different from a pure university, in a way that a Fachhochschule has a more practical approach. So we teach more craft skills, so to speak. At my university in Kassel, I didn't have that. Everything I wanted to learn, I pretty much had to do in self-study with the company of my professor, of course, but most of mm-hmm. that I had to do by myself. And at our university, we teach Unity basic courses, engine basic courses, basic programming, basic character design, all of that. So that's a huge difference. And of course, and that's the major difference, and I still haven't made peace with that. People only study 3 and 3.5 years in these mm-hmm. institutions, in Fachhochschulen. And that is not a lot of time, I think, especially in a medium that is so complex. And if the students that are great when they start, that's also another observation, they will be great in whatever system you throw them. I think that's one idea I have. It really, for those students, it really doesn't matter. They will go their way. So these few genius students, they will go their way in whatever system. But I think for all the others, it takes a lot of time to learn how to work in the medium of games, because you need to know programming, you need to know basic art skills, composition, you have to understand timing, dramatization, all of that. So it's a very complex field. And I think 3.5 years should be seen as a base training. And some of our students, one of the best students, they even managed to come to a level where you can see them as authors of games, I would say. This is like the idea we have in our study program. We want to create authors in games like these. And it's similar to the idea my Kassel University has. We want to create these personalities. Like, for example, I studied with Lea Schönfelder, who was a guest here as well, if I remember.
Yes, or not.
Correct. A very correct. Awesome guest.
She is one of the most interesting authors in games I know. And that's the kind of idea we are following in the bachelor program. But that being said, it takes time. And I think 3.5 years are definitely enough time to learn the craft and to get into that whole idea of the medium. What is the medium about? And sometimes it's even possible to be an author, but I think a master program, or how you want to call it, diplome, a longer program is better if you want to have these kind of director personalities, because you need more time. You need to have more experiences in life. You need time to digest these experiences, all of that. So I think bachelor is like a base program, and then next step would be spending some more years perfecting that.
And I suppose you need time to, that's what studies give you, right? Like time to, like you described, to kind of do whatever, which I think is the time in which you find out, well, what if I have the time to do whatever? What is whatever? Like, what do I do? And that's where maybe the seed of the author, of the artist, of the creator, of the director, maybe not the word, more a corporate association, but let's keep the previous words. The seed of that can break through the topsoil, kind of, but only with time and freedom, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. So I think, you need time and freedom. You don't, and that's something I try to avoid within the boundaries of legalness, to have too much stiff frameworks in my courses. Of course, you have to have some framework because we also have curricula and all of that. And it makes sense to have some sort of drama in your curriculum, But I totally agree.
And so what do you think about the you know, because there also need to be kind of soldiers is the word that comes to my mind, people who can do a job. Is that not important, or do you think somebody else should do that job, or how do you see that with regards to? I mean, people might want to just do a bachelor and then get a job because they would. Yeah. Flourish much more in a company under the direction of one of the directors that you also want to create. But of course, there are always more people who can just do a job than there are genius director creator
types. Of course. And that's perfectly fine. It really, like you said, it really depends on what you want and how you want to work and how much stress you want to endure during your work. Because this kind of director role can be very stressful, of course, and that's something that somebody has to like or at least has to endure. And I also forgot one thing I want to mention that I haven't touched yet. I think university is also about learning these kind of social skills, because like making games is a team effort most of the time, and you need to understand how to handle conflicts, how to make sure that your team is well. And all these soft skills, I think this is something, I think craft, for example, if you want to learn a program, you don't necessarily need a university. You can just download some tutorials and ask some friends and get together and learn that, I think, if you're self-motivated. But I think what you really build at the university are these social skills and also this network of connections. I don't know how it is with you, but I still, and that's probably also because of the creative field, I still have a lot of connections from my university years to people I work with still. And this professional network, that is something that is very important, I think. And that's built during the university time. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it really depends. Maybe that's the answer. It depends what you want to be in the end. Yeah.
Open-ended.
What to find out, at least. it's also good to find that out because you don't know that when you start studying. I thought I would do comics for the next 20 years. And then I was doing animated movies and games. So it's also good for finding out, yeah, learning about yourself during the studies.
So now we go over to you as an artist a little bit. Mm-hmm. And can you describe your art style for people who have never seen any of your work?
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, it evolved during the last 10 years. That's normal. But I think right now it is a Ligne Claire influenced. Ligne Claire is like Tim and Struppi and all these comic books with a very graphical approach to images. It's very colorful. It wasn't colorful. Tiny and Big Times, it was very sandy and gray and brown.
Tintin, by the way.
Tintin.
Tim and Struppi in English.
Yes. Right?
Just as a comment for the non-Germans.
And it is... maybe to be more abstract, I really enjoy busy pictures, Wimmelbilder. I really like images that have a lot of information that overwhelm you. And Florian, who knows me, knows this as well. I have a very high tendency to collect stuff of various kinds. I really enjoy stuff around me. I have my whole flat and working room is filled with stuff that I just find interesting. So I really like things. As inspiration as well, and that can also be found in my imagery. I think I really enjoy images that I can look at for a very long time, on the illustration side, of course, and on the comic side, because I still really, and that's one of my next projects when I have time. I really enjoy doing comic books, obviously that is a big influence, starting with the big classics that you know. So it was my whole stylistic was very influenced by my early heroes. Like in my studies, I really enjoyed Geoff Darrow, who was, some people know from making the designs for Matrix, the movie of the robot. That's something I really like. Of course, Mobius and Chris Ware and all the big superstars of the indie comic scenes. And of course, this is a big influence still. And over the course of the year, my stylistic, like the way I draw things, has become more graphically more simple, and hopefully more on point.
And I quickly want to enter here. I'm browsing your website while we speak. And for anybody who's listening who might want to do the same to get an actual image of the imagery, good
that
idea,
nice.
Maybe.
Yeah. Internet, yeah.
the-stamm.com. THE-STAMM.com. That's where you find Stamm's art, and it's awesome. I'm really enjoying looking at it. So yeah, just feel free to continue. I just want to give the opportunity to, you know, image. It's best to look at imagery, right?
Can you spell com once more for the audience, please?
COM. It's a usual internet thing we do.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I'm just visited by my son.
Hello, son.
Hello, son.
Hello, son.
He wants to... He sees that I'm sitting at a screen, and obviously he wants to have a screen as well, which is...
It's a modern psychological phenomenon. Yeah. It's called screen envy.
Screen envy, exactly. Where's my screen?
Give me a screen.
Yeah, and that's about it. I also really... like drawing weird characters and coming up with interesting designs for objects and characters. Maybe that's another thing you could say about the stylistic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, everybody go check out the artwork. We will also include links within the podcast description, within the episode description, so it's easily findable. Mm. Another question about being an artist, and also one where I know that we have our fair share on disagreements, because obviously I'm entering that framework from the from the complete opposite side. So as an artist, there's always this fight between creating art and also selling or marketing it. Of course, there's art that has to be made and has the specific goal of being used for advertising, for example. And as I know, this is your absolute favorite way of creating, right?
You're touching a very sensitive point. Yeah, of course not. No. Yes, maybe to broaden the question. Because it's...
Don't only broaden your answers, just enhance the question even more, yes.
Because I think it's always making things and selling things. And my goal was always... And for I'm very happy about that. It works until now. And hopefully in the future. I always try to do things. And I know some other illustrators who had the same like philosophy about their game, about their way of working. I try to do things and develop aesthetics and then try to find people who want to give me money for that. This is a different approach than you could have, for example, if you are a storyboard artist. You have to be very versatile and have to have different ways of stylistics that you can offer. But I didn't want to do that. I want to develop this whole, and this is very closely connected to world building. I wanted to have this whole world of ideas and characters and like this place in my mind. And I want to put a lot of effort into that and time, constantly working on that. And then somebody comes along and says, yes, I work for, I don't know, recently I did something for a beverage company and they said, I want to do this. This kind of beverage advertisement, can we use your artworks? And this is something I want to be booked for the content, more or less. So this is one of the approaches I have. And advertising to me, if I would purely work in advertising, I would be just sad. There has to be more for me personally. This is my personal opinion. I could even go further with that, but it wouldn't fulfill me completely because I think you always, and it depends on the job, obviously, and the way the company you advertise, you make advertisement for, what they want, what their needs are, what their brand is. But you always go into compromise, which is good on one hand because it makes your art sometimes more dense. But you always have to compromise on some levels. And if you go to a point where the compromise destroys the idea of the art, then it just gets soulless decoration.
And that happens all the time, by the way. I mean, what you're describing is near to me, too. And it has a lot to do with power, too, with inner power, you know, with freedom again, with, you know, I am the artist and I do what I want. And then that is good. I know that because it's my seed that we talked about earlier.
Yeah,
My inner seed that I have cultivated, the plant, the creative tree or whatever. And I know it's good. Book me for that. It's not like, oh, let me lend my ability to move a pen across the paper you. Exactly. So you may create your commercially interested communication, right? That's a whole different... That's a whole different game. That's a whole different thing. And you have you have no power. Everybody can always say to you, well, just could you use another pen? Could you use a different word? Like, no, man.
Can you draw a monkey? Yeah.
Well, then we can't pay you. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So like, this is sensitive. Like, this is important. If you have any, as a person, right? If you have any sense of, well, not any sense, but like a strong sense, a certain strength of sense of self and who you are and what you do and what your style is, then I suppose you have to act like that. Otherwise, you will be just sad, to quote a wise man.
Or not fulfilled. I think if you look, and I don't own a classic television machine, but if if I visit people who have some and I look at all the commercials you see, this is trash. This is shit. This is like people go to Instagram and see, oh, this stylistic is very hip and nice and interesting. But to me, it always feels very shallow. So there's no soul in that's one point, however you want to call it. But you just see it as decorative.
Well, you find this in everything that's mass produced. I mean, you can find it in music on the radio, and there are some pop music gems, but many are not. Mm-hmm. You can find this in everything that's mass produced, and it has no soul. I've also heard this. I'm seeing on your website, I'm seeing this little mm-hmm. drawing of a little dude standing on a car, and it's like a cool bricky mm-hmm. car. And mm-hmm. There's this thing I've heard about refinement culture, which is mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. I've seen on Twitter a lot, which is like you look at like all the medium SUV models, like variations of, let's say, Audi Q3, Q5, somewhere in between.
Yeah,
no they affiliation all look, with the podcast.
Yeah, yes. Oh, is this a bad thing to say?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, okay. So this is just trying to describe reality with an image, right? And then you see all the different SUVs of all the different many, and they all look the same, basically, all the same shape.
Yeah.
And but bricky cars are like cool. Everybody sees an old bricky car, and it's like, oh, that's kind of cool. I mean, it might not be the best for the aerodynamics or whatever, but it's cool.
Another
really interesting thing that I like is that in the NBA, if you look at a diagram of shots taken from spot, like around the 3-point line and the zone, basically, back in the day, it was a very an image. The dots were kind of everywhere, you know. More like at the 3-point
spread,
more like that. Of course, with hot zones in the zone and outside the 3-point line, and now it's just 3-pointers or just zone. Nobody shoots twos anymore, you know. Like nobody goes halfway and like, no. Either you shoot from below the basket or you shoot from downtown for three, and that's that happens, you know. It's nature that like
it's chaos. Exactly.
People get better. People do what works kind of really aggressively, but there's a really problematic thing about that in some way.
I want to add something to that, because one of the key memories I have from my studies is I studied a very long time with my very beloved Professor Hendrik Dorgarten. And at one point I told him that I'm now doing video games and not comic books for the next year. And he said, "So you're working with coders?" And I said, "Yes, of course." And he said, "Be aware of that. This kind of efficiency thinking will destroy your brain."
That's hilarious.
And I didn't understand it, to be honest, at that point. But I always thought about what does he mean? And now I understand it at one point that this and I don't want to say software engineering is a bad thing per se, but this philosophy behind software, this thinking about efficiency that you have to have, of course, otherwise your games wouldn't run on a computer. But this over these aesthetic of being efficient, they can really destroy your chaotic brain. And I think you need some sort of chaotic brain to make interesting content in a way that you streamline everything, you make everything efficient, your storytelling is efficient, you know, and then it becomes shallow. But that's more like a creativity topic.
Yeah, that's order and chaos. I mean, that's everywhere. Yeah. Like everything that's aggressively orderly tends to become somewhat tyrannical or something in a way. Like it won't leave breathing room. And everything that's aggressively chaotic is like kind of destructive and out of bounds and doesn't lead anywhere. You know, it's the classic dichotomy between that's Florian's question, right? It's like art versus selling, you know, what do you do? And of course you want to bring that together. And mm-hmm. I mean, if we look at the success of games where, mm-hmm. especially games where somebody like you is involved, an original artist, that's where the magic happens. That's like hardcore mm-hmm. chaos, art, creativity, and like mm-hmm. very good coding and design. Yeah. If they meet, and of course they can make very, very beautiful babies and And that's the magic of the middle, or the potion of the two, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that works. Course, you have some sort of friction or tension between order and exactly.
And that's where the heat generates in the tension. Like that's where the good stuff happens, right?
The hotness. Yeah.
When it gets hot. Hot. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
That's obviously that question was a setup. Because you even brought in again expanding on every level. This is the mind bending podcast, like. Of course, there is that inherent fight of like being creative and having to sell it. And in some teams or in some even solo projects, one person has to have a brain for all of these things. Maybe, I mean, there are very interesting projects done by people. Mm. For example, Death Trash. Also from Berlin, recently released a very
big shout out.
Famous.
Yeah. Big shout out, big love big from all around. Mm.
Maybe podcast appearance, hopefully at some point.
Yeah. Yes, please.
So that person, I mean, not him specifically, but in general, a person who works like that has to have a brain for all of these topics at the same time, or will lack them in the finished project, unless they are somewhat of the perfect four-dimensional being or whatever. Mm-hmm. But
which we all are.
Yes. No, but I mean, in teams, usually that's why people have different roles. In some teams, as we used to be on a team, obviously those components will somehow clash.
Of course. Yeah.
Or will bring out a better product in the end. So that's obviously also part of the fun to see where it leads.
And all I'm saying is that maybe two more things. I think the ideal thing you can achieve is that in most cases, and if you do like real politics, if you're being realistic about the market and blah, blah, I think if you achieve it in most cases that you do something you like, that comes from your realm of art things you do, and somebody gives you money for that, I think that's one of the ultimate goals that you can achieve, at least from my perspective. So if you can work commercially and also do what you like, I think that's, for me at least, a ideal combination. And I don't think there's one or the other. I think they can coexist. You just have to find this niche that works for you. Mm-hmm. So if you're the person who's famous for drawing orcs on mopeds, then you have to coin that niche for yourself and find people who enjoy
orcs on mopeds. That's yes. Right. And one more comment from my end on that. I really think that's so true and it's so important. And I think there's no, there's kind of the obvious narrative of, well, like, let's say rich people bad, you know, real estate, you know, and that's kind of I look outside of the window and see houses and it's kind of the that's a structure. It's literally called structure, right? And that's the, oh, that's just money and that's soulless and that's mean, blah, blah, blah. And that's kind of this one extreme. And then there's the other extreme of kind of the starving artist who does everything he wants and it's super romantic, but he runs around in rags. And neither of the two is truly desirable. And I think it's an important check on narrative. What you said is like, yeah, that's what you want to do as an artist. You want to find your niche. And I think age of the internet, it's very much doable because niches are much more visible and can be made more visible. And then you get that and you find people who want to pay you for that, whether it's customers or commercial customers. And so that's so possible right now, which is so cool. And I think it should be such an encouragement to any artist or artist team to go after that. And then, you know, you have a great mix. You do what you want and you're at least not poor. I think that's
nice. Yeah.
Super desirable and not to be shunned, right? Like there's no shame in even being rich in a way. I mean, that is wealth. That is freedom with doing what you want. Of course, you don't want to compromise yourself and be a super soulless suit, unless that's really what you want to do. Yeah,
go like, for it.
I just want to underline that point there, man. I think you're on the money with it, and it shouldn't be underestimated.
I think it's about finding your audience, and of course we talked a lot about this commercial aspect, but also if I do something like a game or whatever, a comic book, and there's only at least 3 to 4 people who enjoy this medium and then come to me and say this just added something to my emotional experience, then I'm happy. So it's also about, I think, just creating stuff that some people see, and then get something from that. I think the worst thing, at least for me, would be to create something and not go into a communication with any audience, just working into the draw.
That's the worst thing for you?
That would be the worst thing. Of course, I do that sometimes just for the joy of drawing, because I like the process of drawing, and I do sketches and all that stuff. Nobody will ever see it. It's just for me and the pleasure of drawing. But I think if I create a story and I put in characters that I want people to relate with, or that have experience like other people, then I really want to go into a conversation with the audience. Yeah, that is important for me. Yeah. And then I'm happy with the work.
And since Simon managed finding niche, and this podcast is part of a metaverse, and we all love world building. If you want to find out more about niches, then check out our previous podcast episode. That's a inside hint. So I will go to some more short answer questions usually, but this one, the first one for you, might not be a short answer question. My standard question usually is, what's your favorite event? And the first is, what's your favorite event to do business? And I know you don't like business events, so this will be a different first question, which is, what was your favorite work trip? Why was it with me? And why was it not to the expo in Milan?
Whatever that is.
I mean, you can't beat the expo in Milan, I think.
What happened at the expo in Milan?
So we had marble bathtubs and enjoyed. No, but maybe to give some context. So it's like that at Black Pants Studio, when we, at the point where we did a lot of games, most of my colleagues, they just wanted to work on the game, and they didn't really like traveling at that point. So I always asked somebody I liked and I could imagine traveling with to join me. And at one point, Florian and I went to the World Exhibition in Milano, and we presented our game at the German booth as an example of a game that was made in Germany. That was a wonderful trip, because it was so surreal. Everything was surreal, I think, because it was totally different from a business convention that you would normally go to. That was nice, but I also enjoyed the trip I made with Florian. That was our second trip together to Litauen. What is Lithuania. It? Lithuania, thank you. To a very small festival, and I think that would sum it up. I enjoy going to smaller festivals. Because I think the conversations are much more, not efficiency driven, but more comfy and not that business oriented.
Yeah. It's not a conference, it's a conference.
Comfy, yeah, exactly.
Conference.
New business ideas with Simon Oler. Pitching to you now.
Yeah.
all free use. Like, I'm not about to create a conference soon, but you can if you want to.
I would come.
Talk about it after. All right. So,
yeah, but my favorite trip was the IGF.
True. And I wasn't there, so that's the correct answer. if you have one, what is your favorite event to hang out with people? It doesn't even have to be a games event, because I know you also enjoy different kind of events.
For a lot of reasons, some of them are nostalgic. I really enjoy going to the Comic Salon in Erlangen, which is only every 2 years. And I haven't been to that for, I don't know, 4-5 years. And then also it was canceled during the pandemic. So this is like the, one of the bigger game and comic, especially comic conventions. I really enjoy that because that's where I started and where also the publisher, when I have time to make a comic, they always have their booth there and it feels like very familiar and like a family to go there. So I really enjoy that.
That's an answer. Or do you need four again?
No. I was going for four.
Okay. This isn't the list.
I like lists.
Yes, that's why the next question on the list is being asked right now.
Oh, so funny.
What makes Berlin a unique place for you?
It's vastness. I'm still puzzled by the vastness of Berlin, all the areas you can go to, all the places you can find. That is very unique to me. That's one point. And the other point is the way people are here, the way you can be here, like this more or less freedom you have to be or to do whatever you want. That's maybe I can sum it up like that. Mm-hmm. It's a very open-minded city. And I always have the feeling that compared to other cities where you have a lot of structures already very pre-built and grown over centuries, a lot of stuff is still moving in Berlin and very fluid. And that's what I like about the city.
Right.
It's slowing down, obviously, with all the stuff happening, but it still feels a little like that.
Last short question. Mm-hmm. How do you define success?
Like personal.
That's an open-ended question.
That is a very good question. Okay, simplest answer, if the thing is published. Mm-hmm. That's a very short answer. If it's done.
All right. So that was my pre-planned questions. So maybe the co-host wants to do some lifting as well here.
I do like to lift various things. This is now the welcome to what did we say earlier? Balance and
lifestyle. No, lifestyle. Wellness
with Simon and wellness. Exactly. I'm always very curious about, you know, how people get influenced. And, you know, we heard a bit about your character and your person and what you care about. And so I want to know from you, where and how did you grow up? Who are your parents, if you want to talk about that? And who else maybe influenced you or what influenced you?
I grew up in Oberfranken, like in Upper Franconia, which is the most upper and most eastern part of Bavaria.
Must not be called Bavaria, right? It is Franconia. It's very important to you guys.
It's very important to the people that live. Yeah. Yes. So it's like it's also called Bavarian Siberia, and that I think that sums it up pretty well. So at least it used to be like that. It was a area of Bavaria nobody wanted to live, like historically. Also, the whole Protestant movement was moved there, so the Catholics could be in Munich and all of that. So historically, it's been more like a toilet of
an outhouse. Bavarian
outhouse. Yeah.
Greetings go out to my family.
Yeah. No, and it's very. The weather is not that best compared to other cities in Bavaria. All that, but that's where I grew up in a very big family. With a lot of uncles and cousins and all of that. My father was one of four kids from a farmer family, and he is a electric engineer. That's what my father worked in, and my mother worked in a kindergarten as a educator. And I have one sister who is a musician and also an educator in music. And that's the whole gang. And we lived in this house with my grandparents and my great-great-grandma. So family was always a big topic for me and still is, like this kind of in working, I don't know, this kind of tribe thing where you have, where you spend some hours with your grandpa. So I really had, I would say for my taste, a real nice childhood and upbringing. With a lot of nature and a lot of trees and a lot of time to do stuff with my friends, things like that. So I really, that was great. And I'm forever thankful for this childhood. It was a really great time and very prägend, very influencing to me as well. And also what you have growing up in a very, very small village is you have this village boredom. Because there's nothing. There's just, I don't know, there's a butcher and there's a supermarket and there's trees and that's it. And you have to do things by yourself. And at one point I had a very nice conversation with a very old professor from a university. And she said that this always fosters like creativity. And a lot of my friends actually also landed in the creative field. Not all of them, but I think this growing up with not too much information going around is really helpful in doing things. And Florian knows that as well, that we didn't even have a nice place to go to as young people. And then we created our own place and founded some sort of, how would you call it? A club, a bar.
Youth like club.
A place to sit and drink beer. More or less, and have concerts and all of that. So this was very influential in me, in this DIY culture that you have to have when you don't have a lot of offerings around you culturally or whatever. That was my upbringing. And I spent most of the weekends and during my puberty, I hated that visiting uncles and aunts and nieces and cousins. So I always visited a lot of people. And that's it. That's what was very influential to me. And of course, as I spent like, I don't know, 18 years at the same point on this planet, I'm also very rooted to that place. I still have very fond memories. I still like it when I'm there. It's just a place where I spent a lot of time and had a lot of good experiences.
Sounds fantastic, man. Like, yeah. I'm quite there with you, you know? And it's like, wow, that's nice. I mean, the name fits it too, you know, rootedness.
Yeah,
Big family tree.
Yeah,
nice, huh?
Yeah,
that's nice. So you guys did that together, huh? This youth center. This beer drinking place that you made.
Yes,
we called it a cultural club. But it boiled down to organizing concerts and just hanging out with a lot of friends. Yeah. And that was very nice.
Did you start it together from scratch?
Yeah.
No, yeah. I wasn't there in the beginning.
This friend Achim, and he said, okay, let's make a club and rent a room and then make a bar. And to make a club in Germany, you need this kind of Statuten, this kind of document where you talk about your club
license.
Yeah, no more like your what do you call that?
It's like a business plan rules. For a club.
Yeah, like your rules and your philosophy and that. And we went to the library and we the only rules we found were from a monastery. So
what?
So yeah, from the cloister in Selbitz. And we just copied the monastery rules and changed them a little bit.
I didn't even know that.
I mean, that's the original place for making and drinking beer, right? That are monasteries. So actually
that's
you're
why
right.
We never did anything.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I came there with high hopes.
Yeah.
Assumed from the start.
I can see you guys as monks, by the way. Just, you know, the bearded one, the bald one, putting on some robes.
Yeah, that works as an image pretty well. Yeah.
But I suppose your behavior down there wasn't that monk-like.
No, it was like a classic youth behavior, I would say.
Classic youth behavior. Classic youth we behavior. All know it. Okay, man, that's so nice. Well, I don't know. I'm still like reveling in this image, you know, of like, I mean, I grew up a little bit like that too, and I get uprooted, unfortunately. I think it was relatively it is what it is, but like relatively bad for me. And if I hear this kind of, but because many things for me are similar too, you know, kind of big family, many cousins, everybody's younger than me, but so they came after me, but it's still nice. And one question that was left open was you mentioned that you hated visiting everybody as a in puberty, but there was some thing unsaid in there, because it sounded like in the end you are quite grateful to have done that.
Yeah, of course. In hindsight, that was just But when you, I don't know, when you're 16, you want to go to concerts, drink beer, and meet people to have sex with, and you don't want to sit somewhere and eat cake, for example. Yeah. And that was just it just didn't fit my idea of a good weekend.
Yeah.
Fair enough. But in hindsight, I really treasure all of that. And it, like, and Florian already knows that at one point I want to go back in that area, like live there again.
That's nice.
And I'm working on that.
Very nice. Yeah. Back to the countryside. We're going to see that a lot in the next 10 years. Many,
it's very people. Trendy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's important. I mean, the cities are full, and well, maybe that brings us to a point, because I'm so interested in, we talked about the this kind of will of power, artistic self-influence, and you mentioned that the countryside left open this, well, basically this giant canvas of nothing is here to influence us, what can we do to influence it, so to speak, opening perfect. A club, yes. And then, well, I'm curious about your artistic ability. You said you started drawing from whenever and continued doing that. And does it have anything to do with where you grew up? Mm-hmm. Who influenced you? Your sister is a musician as well. So what's the story there?
There's this one story that's more like a family myth, but that my uncle brought that up some years ago. And my grandpa, actually, he was an influence I never met, I would say, because he was a farmer, but he was also a painter, an actor, a musician, and he was also in Second World War. And he was like this creative person I never met, because he died very early. And I've never seen him even. And all of these ideas of creativity, they somewhat kept going in our family, which is interesting. And it's like an observation my uncle made. For example, my cousin is an actress, and my sister does music, and I do drawing and illustration. So somewhat, and even my grandpa, who is a fine mechaniker, a very specialized was a mechanic. For I don't know the English term, like very intricate machines, like clocks and stuff like that. So a very, I don't know, rational and engineering-driven person. Even he did a lot of drawing when he was young, which was forbidden to him by the Nazis, which I learned also, because he drew left-handed and they didn't want that and stuff that. Which is actually true. It sounds made up.
I know. My grandma had the same. She was umerzogen. Re-educated. By the way, horrendous term for that. I mean, it's a really, that's really messed up to not swear in this podcast. I would swear. Imagine the swear. It's like, it's messed up. And I mean, it's a shame. There's, I don't know, this beautiful, weird thing about left-handedness, because it's so unusual. And I feel like many left-handed people I know have this kind of special streak. It's just something beautiful, you know?
Yeah, and that's, I guess, one of the reasons why he didn't pursue it at that point. He just forgot about his drawing abilities. So this was all in my family, and this, on one hand, and on the other hand, what really influenced me was it's more like in the stories I tell and in the characters I make. It's not the aesthetics, because aesthetics are influenced by a lot of things, like my heroes in the comics industry and also other stuff. But the ideas of stories I want to tell, they always tend to go around the idea of family, what is family, and all of that. So that's where that comes from, I guess. And also my grandpa and my mother are also people who enjoy stuff and things. So the whole house I grew up in is filled with content of various kinds. And that's something I inherited from them. And that's also found in my artwork, again, in the illustrations that are always very full. And they have this plethora of stuff that you can get lost in. I think that's where that comes from as well. And my love for science fiction, that comes from my father, because he, and that was always very impressive to me, he had this big library of science fiction books, like old 60s and 70s science fiction books, and I really enjoyed that. To be honest, most of the stuff I enjoy, at one point my father brought into the family. For example, computers. We had a very early version of a home computer with a cassette deck, and then afterwards a C64, a Commodore, and all of that.
468, so, maybe after that.
Exactly, yeah, with a
486.
486, yeah.
It's funny because I just have the same. I always like to relate, and yeah, my grandpa was an engineer, and he brought the C64, and then the 486. Yeah. I think even 386 before that, and it's just I remember that kind of anthology of computers. Like, that's nice, mm-hmm. man. I remember mm-hmm. all the computers I played on, and they were all special, and one was faster than the previous one. Ah, such a good time.
That's, yeah, and I have a lot of, like, all these new media popping up. I have so many good memories on the one hand, and also that also influenced, I think, my work a lot, because I'm not just doing one thing. I always skip between stuff. Yeah.
So it's almost like you had this this very open canvasy surrounding, but this really dense content forward mm-hmm. family. That's kind of cool, right?
If you can put it like, you can put it like that.
Because that means that you had the balance. You had you had input. You know, something that was there, and you just had to leave the house, and there was nothing, and then you could like bring almost like bring that into the world. Like,
Yeah, you could frame it like. I've never thought about. Yeah, but that's true. That's exactly like. Yeah.
Well, it's just what I see in the moment. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can go off what you tell me, and I'm always curious. You know, the order and the chaos. What's there? Where's the vacuum? Where's the mm-hmm. filledness? And it's fun to me. It's fun to me. Florian, I think you had a question about in the line that Stamm was going, right?
Yeah, I mean, we touched on it a little bit. So I lied a little bit before. That was one more question I had, but we thought it would be better. It would fit better in a later stage. Yeah. So talking about where both of us grew up and talking about inspiration and the people there, I know and that characters and stories that you've worked on take a lot of inspiration from there. So the question is, what does home mean to you?
That is obviously changed over the years, but it's like the place where I have people I like, more or less. I mean, obviously there's this whole discussion about what is Heimat, what is like your upbringing, home and stuff like that. And but that's different for me. Home, and I moved quite a lot in the last years is that, that's where I have some people I can have a good exchange with on what layer, howsoever. This doesn't have to be artistically. I just want to be surrounded by some people I like, and then that's home for me. Mm-hmm. So that more like that. If there are no people, it gets hard. But if there are those people, then I'm happy. Yeah,
that's nice. Yeah, and that's a good segue into something I want to ask you from kind mm-hmm. of the previous part, because you talked a lot about teams. You talked mm-hmm. about these golden combinations, and I think that's a little narrative I want to explore with you before we maybe start wrapping up at some point in the near future. But mm-hmm. Golden combinations, what have you experienced in that way? Just a few pointers, but you can go in any direction you'd like. How many people? What type of people? Is it at all systematizable? Like, can you put a framework around it, or is it purely individual? What happens? And then I'm also wondering about conflict hygiene. You brought that up. I'm very curious about that. So that seems to be something that you've interfaced with a lot, this kind of group dynamic and small teams. So yeah, please let's talk a bit about that. That's very interesting to me.
First of all, I think there's this whole, I think the best comparison or the best images I have or I found were like that. This, if you compare it with a band or with people who make music.
I really like that comparison, by the way. I had the same feeling before. Yeah. Sorry, please.
Because it makes sense on so many levels to me, I think. And of course, you have this, and that's probably something culturally as well. You have this kind of genius idea that you have this Goethe personality or this Michael Jackson or whatever person that is just this brilliant artist who does it all by himself and he knows a lot of stuff. And that exists. I don't want to say it doesn't exist. It does very much exist. And there are a lot of examples in the game industry for that as well. But I think for me, I tend to be more creative. And that's something that really depends on your personality, I guess. If I at one point can talk to people about ideas, it is not in the beginning of the process. That's still when the idea is fragile and not birthed yet, but if it's somewhat more solid, then the roughing out, and that's a also American concept, like writer's rooms, for example. You have people who work together on a script, and it brings a lot of benefits. You have a good exchange, you progress faster, I think. You don't get lost in unnecessary places that don't lead nowhere. That happens sometimes to me, at least when I work alone. And that's all very positive about teamwork for me, for my personality trait. And the reason why I think about that even more nowadays is because at the university I worked with one teacher, external teacher, who taught a lot about creative producing and team dynamics and things like blind spots in the team and emotional capacities of team members. And I think you were asking for like a systemic approach to that thing. I think to some point you can even have that, because you have all these different tasks in a company or in an independent game studio, for example, where you need somebody who goes to business events and he has to be, in the best of all cases, charismatic and nice to be around with. So you need some sort of qualities, I think, in certain jobs.
Yeah.
And
that's why I always went to the business events and you stayed home.
Yeah. That is exactly the reason. and that's, I think you, yeah. And if you compare it to a band, you need somebody who keeps the drums going, and you need a lead singer who does artistic stuff or whatever.
You need somebody who gets the band together so they practice.
Exactly, who drives the bus.
Gigs. You need somebody who, you know, there's a lot of actual management in a band too. And the system is nice. I know I asked about it. Now I'm very curious about, like, can you maybe tell a story about like a golden combination you had? Like, I mean, as far as that's okay, you think for people involved, like I would really I really love when a team flows, and I would love to hear a story from you. And who was there, and what did they do? You know, who are the characters in that little movie? What was going on? If you have a story like that, maybe.
I had some of these combinations. The maybe if we take Black Pen Studio, for example, which started as a, I don't know, 6-people enterprise, that turned out to be an 8-people enterprise, and then we were a 5-people enterprise. So this combination was forming in the beginning. People were coming in, people were getting out. But at the moment when we made Tiny and Big, we had one game designer, his name is also Florian, who is very conceptually creative. He has these kind of weird ideas, and he really thinks more or less outside of the box. But he also had some very crazy ideas. For example, in our game, you could cut rocks, and at some point, this would make the game crash because all these rocks you cut, they were simulated physically in a correct manner, and this just made the computer shut down at some point. And his idea was that this is part of the game, that you're always afraid that your game will crash. Lord. And we were saying, no, that's insane.
Correct, that's insane. That's why it's good.
Yeah, exactly. So he was like this person with a very strong and very creative idea of what the game should be, very chaotic. And at one point, Toby joined us, who is still in the company, and he is very orderly. So they were always in conflict, and this conflict was positive. So we created a nice balance with that, I think, by making the game.
That was the heat generator, right?
Yeah. And also the person who caged this crazy ideas that would have just crashed the game.
Literally.
And then we had Christian at one point, who was like a very serious and very approachable. He was doing business very well, I think, on a very bodenständig. He was very down to earth. And very approachable. He was responsible that we were one of three companies on Steam at that time. And the other company was, I don't know, Dedalic, I think, and maybe Crytek, and we, like the little persons from Kassel in their studio. And that's all to him, because he, in San Francisco at one point, he went to the booth of Valve, and he just talked to the people and drank beer with them, and he did that perfectly. So that was good. That was also good. And I did the artworks, so that worked as well. And
did you have a type of role that you kind of described for the other people? Like a kind of, did you clash with someone? Did you mesh with someone? What's your kind of social?
I tend to be, or at least I tended to be, that has changed. But I was very conflict shy, so I was always trying to keep up the harmony of the team. Mm. And also, I was always very optimistic and motivated. I think that also helped. And at one point, but this conflict shyness also, if we want to be really honest, created a lot of problems, because when you're in a production, you need to talk about conflicts. And that's something I personally had to learn, how to manage that and how to navigate that.
How did you learn that? Just curious, because I know this very well.
How I learned that, I learned... Or
when, by, course, by which situation, whatever. Yeah.
In the classic way, when everything escalates. and then you see, okay, that it should have never escalated like that. I don't remember the exact...
Have brought it up earlier.
Maybe. Yeah, exactly. And I really learned, and that's why I enjoyed my teaching so much at the university. I learned a lot about that as well when I was teaching, by observing other teams very closely, like student teams, how they behave, what happens. And some of these strategies you have in a team, or how you deal with conflict and creative conflicts as well, they are just, they keep happening over and over due to a lot of reasons. For example, one being the roles are not clear in the team. You don't know who's responsible for the art. Is there one person? Are there four persons? What is the process? What is the pipeline? And all of that. And then there were many more people in the team. There was Sebastian Schulz, who was also a programmer, and he was more pragmatic at that point. He just put out a shitload of code that just worked but was not pretty. That was very fast but also caused problems. So I think that all these little things that you need in a game production that Florian also mentioned, they were at one point existent in our team.
All right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we already brought up Conflict Now and kind mm-hmm. of the crew, the band. And so you really very explicitly, in my opinion, earlier mentioned conflict hygiene so explicitly that I wrote it down. So yeah. Could you maybe expand on what that means to you?
I try to maybe frame it so it doesn't sound too generic, but I think what you need as a game developer is this sort of... or like in a family are these moments where you come together and talk about problems, for example. So it could be a day, it could be a date. And I think it's even good to understand how to deal with these problems because some people in your team are introverts, some of them are extroverts. How do you get everybody the right amount of time to speak their mind? What are the processes to do that? And I think this is something every team has to design for itself, I think. And hygiene, because you have to do it over and over. I think you have to do it like, I don't know, every week. That's like the rhythm we came up with in the end after the two games we made. And even then, it was still sometimes that we just missed stuff, that somebody was, I don't know, sad for reasons nobody knew or was just stressed too much because of creative decisions we made and all of that. So I think that's one of the big quests. That's more like a relationship thing,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, it is.
Because you have this relationship with these people that you spend like 8 hours a day and you just have to find a way to... not kill each other, because it can be very tense, because it's you have all these existential things tied to it. You have your dreams in there and your visions and your it's also economically something at stake and all of that. And sometimes you have these high pressure moments, and if you don't take care of all the other problems before, then it will just escalate and everybody's hateful or just disappointed. And that's something I think that's one of the key features that at least in game production, you have to find for your team.
Yeah, it's a preventer of resentment, and when mm-hmm. resentment is there, it gets really ugly. Then you can't talk straight anymore because everybody is saying everything through a filter of, like you said, hatefulness is strong, but well, it's not wrong. And okay, so I guess then I'm well. You clearly, you know, had to learn a lot around that, and we will not look into every nook and cranny there today. I guess I think the hygiene picture is good because if you look at a flat, you want to clean it somehow every day, somehow every week. You know, there are different dimensions. Maybe you'll tidy up your kitchen every day or every other day. So you can cook freely, right? That's like a process-oriented place. And maybe you clean up, clean your floors every week or so. And, well, but of course, you know, once a half year or once a year, you'll do like a proper into every corner cleaning, usually in spring and after.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think that's, it's worth probably thinking about that if you're a developer or any person who makes anything, where you need to clean in your work, right? It's like it has a lot to do with planning too. With you could say that planning, for me at least, is cleaning up your mind. You know, you have a regular date. Well, if I don't plan once a week, I turn into a complete idiot. I'm not able to live. It's still a mistake I make, but it's a one that I pay for all the time. So, I guess one question specifically about conflict hygiene and teams I had was, did you have the same person always leading such a session? Like, did you have a specific conductor of or process or not even one that you invented, more like one that established itself? Or did it just come up, or how did that work for you? What have you experienced?
You mean like a person who, like a mediator or something who takes?
Yeah, like one person from the team who kind of took that on themselves, or was it always somebody else, or did you just talk in a group? Did you have? I'm just curious. So what you experienced there?
We had this very nice system of that you probably know from school of everybody had some tasks to do in the end. In the team, for example, one person was responsible for getting coffee every week or something like that, or maybe filling out the applications for game festivals or something. So all these small tasks that you have to do that normally in a big company somebody would do, or I don't know, the interns would take care of sometimes. And one was also doing this kind of meeting preparation, and in theory. Sometimes it just didn't work, or somebody was too lazy, of course, or we forgot about that. But the idea was to switch that role. So every meeting is prepared by somebody else. Everybody writes his issues, in a protocol you can read beforehand, and you can twist your mind around that. So you don't do a lot of impulse decisions.
Right.
When you're talking, but you prepare your strategy. For example, if you do a business strategy meeting on the idea of what do we do next, where do we advertise, what is our next production, then you have to prepare that. And we have found some, I think, organically and with a lot of pain before, but we found some ways to organize that. Basically, we had our own wiki, like a Wikipedia page with a lot of ideas and rules and pipelines for everything. And that worked pretty well at some point. It took a lot of time. And sometimes, of course, it didn't work. But that's how we did that. So the person changed. We had different people prepare different stuff. So that was at least the theoretical idea. Yeah.
But so it was quite a conscious way, you know. And then, of course, in the mm-hmm. gaps, things happen, you know, somebody doesn't do something, but
of course,
in a way you were prepared. Okay, that's cool. I think that's very important. That's why I'm so curious about it. I think it applies to so many things. Like I said, you know, actual physical things like your mm-hmm. living space, like your mm-hmm. a weekly organization, and then, of course, your family. I mean, this is really very mm-hmm. applicable to a family. Mm-hmm. So that's a really universal thing, what you're describing. So that's why mm-hmm. I wanted to underline it. It's totally valuable. If you're listening to this is not part of your life, then consider looking at that, because that's really important. It can probably save you from a lot of harm in a way, or enable you to do great things. I suppose it's maybe
the best of all. universes.
Dope. Hey, I have some quick fire questions too.
Okay.
You can answer them quickly if you feel like it. If
I do my best.
You can answer them four-dimensionally if you feel like that. They are simple, not easy, I suppose. I think after that we can wrap up. It would be nice. So my first question is always, what would you say is the purpose of your being?
What? Just being. That's a very, I don't know, Alan Watts answer, but just being there, doing things. Not being an asshole, also important. Yeah.
The purpose of your being is being, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, that's very cool. It seems about right. That's nice. That's a Alan Watts answer to an Alan Watts question.
Yeah, exactly. That nice. Was a setup.
Yeah, you got it. You passed it. nobody ever did this before. Nice. What inspires you?
What inspires me? My of course, my family, my kids, all of that, friends, and then random stuff. I don't have this unique source of inspiration. I think we talked about that once in the preparation for this talk. Also, just the media I consume, more or less. And I find it very hard to get inspiration from the internet most of the time. But sometimes that happens as well. It's mostly books, being outside, sitting at a Späti in Berlin, looking at people. And also, and that's very important, I guess, for my work, things, objects. I'm really inspired by stuff. Exactly, stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, nice. All right. What is a beautiful day to you?
A beautiful day. I don't have any appointments. I sleep at least till 8. I have a very precise idea of a beautiful day.
Yes, let's hear.
Then I have a very rich and hearty breakfast containing eggs at some point.
Good man, good man.
And then I go out. The weather is good.
Yeah, it better be.
It better be good.
Not
Excuse
great.
Me, weatherman. I was planning a beautiful day today.
Yeah, exactly good. What's the temperature like?
It's 28 degrees. Perfect short pants weather. And then I don't know. I'm with people I enjoy, which is my family and also my friends. And I'm just outside. And there's probably some trees. And I can just drink coffee and look at people passing by. That's like a very relaxed, perfect day. And it, at one point, I take a bath. that's also in there.
In what type of receptacle? Like the sea? A lake?
It doesn't matter.
A bathtub?
Just water.
Marble bathtub.
A marble bathtub.
In Milan. And at one point during the beautiful day, I take a bath in a marble bathtub in Milan. So I better be there.
Yeah, that's it. That's my very precise idea of a great day. Yeah.
That's damn right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so righteous. Here's a funny one. What is something you believe that you think most people will disagree with?
That is a very good question. It doesn't matter what you do, I think, and not in a nihilist way. I think it's just important that people do things. This is a very artistic question, answer, maybe, but
it doesn't matter what you do.
Yeah, but
it's
as long
important
as
you, that you do something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And of course, you can bend this answer in all various directions. But what I mean is, I think as long as you do things, I think good things will happen from that. And of course, this makes sense in the context of the whole talk we have. Because I enjoy this kind of activism, but I think it doesn't really matter what medium you chose or whatever, if you do art or if you work at the zoo or whatever, as long as you contribute something or as long as you do something, it's good. If I can, that's a very confusing answer, but I think.
No, I'm fully with it. I really like it, actually. It's kind of like saying, there is nothing is really better than the other thing. It's like,
yeah, I think so.
There's not a kind of imperative to you better do X or
that's
not worth your time.
You have to.
Yeah,
and of course this is this is super controversial as an answer, but
this question is actually designed to create controversy.
To be controversial,
it's a hard question. So thanks for the answer. It's a hard question to answer earnestly and honestly.
Mm.
Yeah, and I think it's a good answer. Nice. Okay. Do you have books that you you often recommend or gift to people? You can say one or maybe three.
Yeah.
Nothing in between. Either one or three.
One or three.
Yeah,
not
correct.
Four. I think, okay, I have to really think about that for a moment. I'm just going to name my favorite three comic books because I really like comic books. I'm not going to talk about these. That's what I normally do at the university. I talk about books that teach you things. Like, this is the greatest book for storytelling I've ever read or something. But I think I'm going to talk about comic books that I really enjoy. And one of the books I like the most, and I always come back to, is called Too Much Coffee Man. It's by a cartoonist from America, and it's this slice of life stories about a superhero who has a cup of coffee on his head and just meditates on life. And it's, to my opinion, it's not my favorite style, but nevertheless, I really enjoy the story. So this is one big recommendation I have.
And do you want to have an interjection on that? Somebody actually drew that character and it hanged it at the youth club back then.
Yeah,
there was on the one wall there was a picture of Too Much Coffee Man.
It was a homage.
Both works. I'm googling Too Much Coffee Man right now, and the images are by Shannon hilarious. So funny. And there's a panel here where the before years where he looks at his brain, I suppose, and yells, "Why don't you work better?" Which has a lot to do with your controversial answer, which is that's cool, man. I'm gonna try to look at this. I kind of like that.
You can find them sometimes in comic stores, but they most of the time sold out. Or I can borrow them to you at one point when
I had a vision during our conversation, a vision of the future, and it involved the three of us and some type of beverage, and so I can see
a marble bathtub
in Milan. It might include a transfer, a very much respected transfer of a comic book. I would very much enjoy that.
Me too. Yeah, we should do that afterwards, instantly.
The Too Much Coffee Man. It might be a metaphor for this podcast as well.
I really enjoy drinking. Yeah, that also makes sense.
Yeah, there was some caffeine involved here. Okay,
and I still have two books to go. One book I like for its stylistic and the way the stories are told, that I don't like for its sexism and all the other stuff that people did in the 50s and 60s, is Nick Natterton. That is one of my most favorite early influences, about a detective that is very, I don't know how to say that. It's very infographical.
How do we spell this?
Nick, N-N-I-C-K, Knatterton, K-N-A-T-T-E-R-T-O-N.
Nick Knatterton. Oh, yes. Very sharply drawn detective.
Man. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And it was very popular in the...
Manfred Schmidt.
Yes, exactly. In the 70s and 60s, I guess. My grandfather introduced me to the animated show of that, and I really like the creativity in that. Of course, there's a lot of stuff that you can really not do today, and that's really offensive in these books. Also want to mention that, but I really, really like all the aspects I mentioned. That was a big influence to me as well. And the third book is which one should I take? Third book is, it's called Scut. Tales from the Disposable Assassin. And that was very influential when I was like 15 or 16. It's about a robot that is designed to kill one target and then self-destruct. And while he's hunting that target, he reads the self-destruction note on his back. And he now knows that if he kills his target, then he will self-destruct. And so he just puts his target in a freezing tank and puts him to the hospital, and now has to work freelance to keep paying the hospital bills.
That's hilarious.
And that's from the world-building aspect. That was super influential to me because all the characters are the most creative and insane ones, maybe comparable to Earthworm Jim, the video game. Mm. Some people probably know. Mm-hmm. So I really like the world building and the storytelling in that. Yeah.
Yeah. Googling it, approving of the imagery. and it's a Scud, S-C-U-D, for anybody who wants to check that out. Yeah.
This is like the very old recommendation.
Yeah, I love that.
Stay with me.
Also, very good metaphor on life. The kind of you kill the target, your mission is over, right? And then, so like, how about you don't set yourself too many goals, but like work in a process-oriented manner? And so he replaces goal with process. It's like goal goes into hospital freezing tank, and now we just have some fun so we can keep doing stuff, whatever it is.
Yeah. And the author wrote that. He was actually Rob Schrapp is his name. He was also involved in creating the TV series Community, and I think the creator of Rick and Morty, that I also really like artistically. They did a lot of collaborations. So in this book, there's a character that has talking knees, for example, and all of that. So it's just a basket of great ideas.
Fantastic. Maybe I should start finding some comic books. That's nice.
Yeah.
That's nice. Fantastic. I have, what do I have? 3-4 more questions.
Okay.
What is the change you want to see in the world?
I think, and that comes from the point I'm currently in, I want to see more slowness. I think people should, or at least I should, be more slow in things and not turn it down a notch, I would say. That would be a great change. And that also refers to spending more time with people you like and going to the nature and all of that. But this answer is clearly influenced from the last 1.5 years. But that would be great, because this would also imply probably not emitting too much carbon, maybe, and also removing some of that stress a lot of people feel. So it I is. Think this more slowness, I think. Mm. That's my short answer.
Good lifestyle for the tree types, the stumps, the ones who there's no speed in the life of a tree.
Yeah.
Okay, so well, my follow up is always, how do you contribute to it? But I think we've heard what a beautiful day is for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of outlines that, so that makes sense. Have you lost anything on your way that you would like to get back?
Oh, that's also a very. I have lost something on my way that I would like to get back. Yeah, actually, yes. I'd like to have a little more time for more randomness in my work. I'm always fighting against that, because that's a topic we already talked about that before, but I really want to get back to this mindset, and I know it's impossible, that I had when I was studying, just sitting in a room and drawing stuff and just going with it, going with the flow. I think it's very hard at one point when you start working in a studio or working commercially, that you keep, that you have that moment of uninfluenced freedom where you just do stuff for doing stuff, because right now I always think, or often think, about the purpose and how can I market this, and is this probably, has this some value, or can it be successful in the subconsciousness? And I think that's something I want to go back to a little more, to this just drawing stuff and let's see what happens.
Very not nice.
Drawing stuff with a purpose in mind. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. And then almost last one. What is something that you haven't done yet, which you would like to do?
I would like to publish a comic book in not in Germany, but in America, with one of my favorite publishing houses. That's one thing I want to do. I would like to, at one point in my life, have some sort of garden where I can sit. That would be nice. And I also wanted at one point travel to Japan once. That's what I want to achieve. And of course, I want to continue working with inspirational people. That's the more obvious thing.
But you've already done that. So it's not part of the question. Excuse me.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
I told you this podcast is mayhem.
Yeah.
Good. My friends, last question. It's not in line of the previous ones, though. Where can people find you to, I don't know, follow you, listen to you, whatever you put out, see you?
Street address.
Yes, also telephone. I do have a Twitter that I don't feed regularly, which is actually never, which is called The Stamm, just the T-H-E, Stamm. That's a place where you can find me. I also do have an Instagram that I have to fill with some content at some point. I have my website, which is the-stamm.com. That's actually the place where you can see most of my work. And also, if you are in Berlin and want to have a creative exchange, I live in Friedenau. You can find me there.
That's hilarious. That's quite a dox, actually.
I was joking about the address.
Yeah. Oh, man. Can't believe you've done this.
Yeah, I did it.
Just go to Friedenau. You will find the Stamm walking around at some point.
Catch me outside.
Being confused. Yeah.
Looking at people in front of a Späti on a beautiful day.
Make sure you don't
disturb the beautiful day unless you're a person who he likes and wants to talk to. Otherwise, you have no place to be there.
In the program.
Fantastic. So I just found your Twitter. It's The Stamm.
Yeah.
At The Stamm. Yeah. Very nice. That's probably the way to find you. The Stamm.
And one thing I forgot, obviously, is the name of the studio I work at and I co-founded. It's blackpants.de, I think. Yes.
You are correct.
Can you spell D-E?
No, I will. I will not.
Oh, fantastic, my friends. This was a very fun time, at least in my personal opinion.
Agreed.
I need a break.
Yeah. Thank you for your, I don't know, for what you've had to tell. It was just so enjoyable.
Likewise. Yeah. Thanks for having me and all the very good questions that I will be thinking about a little longer, I think. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Any last words from you, Mr. Florian?
Thanks, Stamm, for doing this podcast and for anything and everything else.
You guys, see you very soon. And to all you listeners out there, goodbye. Hi there, Simon here. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you like what you hear here and you would like to hear more here, feel free to follow or to subscribe to the podcast on whichever platform you get your audio fix. We appreciate you and we promise you to bring you many more insightful conversations with fantastic games industry guests from Berlin and from all over Europe. Thank you very much and see you very soon. Bye bye.
Hi there. Before you go, this is Florian, project manager for GamesNet Berlin Europe. If you want to stay connected to the network, find out more about upcoming events and links to other MediaNet initiatives, you can visit us at gamesnetberlin.eu and subscribe to our newsletter. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast and until next time.